Side 6.
Chapter 11. Shy Smile. The first thing that struck Bond about Saratoga was the green majesty of the elms, which gave the discreet avenues of colonial-type clapboard houses some of the peace and serenity of a European watering place. And there were horses everywhere, being walked across the streets, with a policeman holding up the traffic, being coaxed out of horse boxes around the sprawling groups of stables, cantering along the cinder borders of the roads, and being led to work on the exercise track alongside the racecourse near the centre of the town. Stable boys and jockeys, white, negro and Mexican, hung about at the street corners, and there was the whinny and the occasional trumpeting scream of horses in the air. It was a mixture of Newmarket and Vichy, and it suddenly occurred to Bond that, although he wasn't in the least interested in horses, he rather liked the life that went with them. Light had dropped him at the Sagamore, which was on the edge of the town and only half a mile from the racetrack, and went off about his business. They agreed to contact each other only at night or casually in the crowds at the races, but to pay a dawn visit to the exercise track if Shy Smile was being given a last workout at sunrise the next day. Leiter said he would know about this, and much more, after an evening around the stables and at The Tether, the all-night restaurant bar that was the home of the racing underworld when they came up for the August meeting. Bond checked himself in at the central office of the Sagamore, signed James Bond, Hotel Astor, New York, before a hatchet-faced woman whose steel-rimmed eyes assumed that Bond, like most of her other seekers after gracious living, intended to steal the towels and possibly the sheets, paid $30 for 3 days, and was given a key to room 49. He carried his bag across the parched lawn, between the beds of beauty bush and forced gladioli, and let himself into the neat spare double room with the armchair, the bedside table, the Courier and Ives print, the chest of drawers, and the brown plastic ashtray that are standard motel equipment all over America. The lavatory and shower were immaculate and neatly designed, and, as Leiter had prophesied, the tooth glasses were contained in paper bags for your protection, and the lavatory seat was barred by a strip of paper which said, "Sanitized." Bond took a shower and changed, and walked down the road and had two bourbon old-fashions and the chicken dinner at $2.80 in the air-conditioned eating house on the corner that was as typical of the American way of life as the motel. Then he returned to his room and lay on his bed with the Saratogian, from which he learned that a certain T. Bell would be riding Shy Smile in the perpetuities. Soon after 10, Felix Leiter knocked softly on the door and limped in. He smelled of liquor and cheap cigar smoke and looked pleased with himself.
"Made some progress," he said.
He hooked the armchair up to the foot of the bed on which Bond was lying. He sat down and took out a cigarette.
"Means getting up damned early in the morning, 5 o'clock. The word is they'll be timing Shy Smile over 4 furlongs at 5:30. I'd like to see who's around when they're doing that.
The owner's given us Pizarro. One of the directors of the Tiara happens to be called that. He's another one with a joke name, Lamebrain Pizarro. Used to be in charge of their dope racket. Ran the stuff over the Mexican border and then broke it down and parceled it out to middlemen on the coast. The FBI got onto him and he did determine San Quentin. Then he came out and Spang gave him the job at the Tiara in exchange for the rap he'd carried. And now he's a racehorse owner like the Vanderbilts. Nice going. I'll be interested to see what sort of shape he's in these days. He was almost a mainliner in the days he was dealing in coke. They gave him the cure in San Q, but it's left him a bit soft in the head, hence the lame brain. And then there's the jock, Ting-Ling Bell. Good rider, but not above this sort of caper of the money's right, and he's in the clear. I want to have a word with Ting-Ling if I can get him alone. I've got a little proposition for him. The trainer is another hoodlum, name of Bud, Rosie Bud. They all sound pretty funny, these names, but you don't want to be taken in by it. He's from Kentucky, so he knows all about horses. He's been in trouble all over the South, what they call Little Habitch, as opposed to a Big Habitch, habitual criminal. Larceny, mugging, rape, nothing big. Enough to give him quite a bulky packet in police records, but for the last few years he's been running straight, if you care to call it that, as trainer for Spang. Leiter flicked his cigarette accurately through the open window into a bed of gladioli. He got up and stretched.
"Those are the actors in the order of their appearance," he said. "Distinguished cast. Look forward to lighting a fire under them."
Bond was mystified. "But why don't you just turn them over to the stewards?"
Who are your principals in all this? Who pays the bills?
Retained by the leading owners, said Lyda. They pay as a retainer and extra by results.
And I wouldn't get far with the stewards. It wouldn't be fair to put the stable boy in the box, be the death sentence for him. The veterinaries passed the horse, and the real Shy Smile was shot and burned months ago. No, I've got my own ideas, and they're going to hurt the spangled boys far more than a disbarment from the tracks. You'll see. Anyway, 5 o'clock, and I'll come and hammer on the door just in case.
Don't worry, said Bond. I'll be on the doorstep with my boots and my saddle while the coyotes are still baying the moon.
Bond woke on time, and there was a wonderful freshness in the air as he followed the limping figure of Lyda through the half-light that filtered through the elms among the waking stables. In the east, the sky was pearly grey and iridescent, like a toy balloon filled with cigarette smoke, and among the shrubs the mockingbirds were beginning their first song. Blue smoke rose straight up in the air from the fires in the camps behind the stables, and there was a smell of coffee and wood smoke and dew. There was the clank of pails and the other small noises of men and horses in the early morning, and as they moved out from under the trees to the white wooden rail that bordered the track, a file of blanketed horses came by, with a boy at each head, holding the leading rein right up close to the bit, and talking with soft roughness to their charges.
"Hey, lazy bones, pick your feet up. Get up. You sure ain't no man o' war this morning."
"They'll be getting ready for the morning works," said Lyda. "The gallops. This is the time trainers hate most, when the owners come."
They leant against the rail, thinking about the early morning and about breakfast, and the sun suddenly caught the trees half a mile away on the other side of the track and brushed the topmost branches with pale gold, and in minutes the last shadows had gone, and it was day. As if they had been waiting for the sign, three men appeared from among the trees away to the left, and one of them was leading a big chestnut with a blaze face and four white stockings.
"Don't look at them," said Lyda softly. "Turn your back on the track and watch that file of horses coming up. That old bent man with them is Sonny Jim Fitzsimmons, greatest trainer in America, and those are the Woodward horses. Most of them will be winners this meeting. Just look casual. I'll keep an eye on our friends. Wouldn't do to seem too interested. Now, let's see. There's a stable boy leading Shy Smile, and that's Bud, all right, and my old friend Lane Brain in a beautiful lavender shirt, always a dresser. Nice-looking horse, powerful shoulders. They've taken the blanket off him, and he doesn't like the cold, bucking around like mad with the stable boy hanging on. Sure hope he doesn't kick Mr. Pizarro in the face. Now Bud's got him, and he's quieting down. Bud's giving the boy a leg up, leading him onto the track. Now he's cantering slowly up the far side of the track to one of the furlong posts. The hoodlums have got their watches out. They're looking round. They've spotted us. Just look casual, James. Once the horse gets going, they won't be interested in us. Yeah, you can turn around now. Shy Smile's on the far side of the track, and they've got the glasses on her to be ready for the off. And it will be 4 furlongs. Pizarro's just by the 5th post.
Bond turned and looked along the rail to his left at the 2 stocky, intent figures with the sun glinting on their glasses and on the watches in their hands, and although he didn't believe in these people, the dusk seemed to seep out around them from under the golden elms. He's off. Far away, Bond could see a flying brown horse rounding the top end of the track and turning into the long stretch towards them. At that distance, not a sound came to them, but quickly there was a soft drumming on the tan track that grew until, with a swift thunder of hooves, the horse rounded the bend in front of them, right up against the far rails, and hurtled on the last furlong towards the watching men. A tingle of excitement ran down Bond's spine as the chestnut flashed by, its teeth bared and its eyes wild with the effort, its gleaming quarters pounding and the breath snorting out of its wide nostrils. The boy on its back arched like a cat in the stirrups, his face low down and almost touching the horse's neck. And then they had gone, in a spray of sound and upflung earth, and Bond's eyes moved to the 2 watching men, now crouching, and he saw the 2 arms jerk downwards as they jammed down the stops on their watches. Lyda touched him on the arm, and they moved casually away and back under the trees towards the car.
"Moving damn well,"
commented Leiter. Better than the real shy smile ever did. No idea what the time was, but he was certainly burning up the track. If he can do that for a mile and a quarter, he'll get home. And he'll have an allowance of 6 pounds, seeing as how he hasn't won a race this year. And that'll give him an extra edge. Now, let's go and have the hell of a breakfast. It's given me an appetite, seeing these crooks so early in the morning.
And then he added softly, almost to himself,
And then I'm going to see how much Master Bell will take to ride foul and get himself disqualified.
After breakfast, and after hearing some more of Leiter's plans, Bond idled away the morning and then had lunch at the track and watched the indifferent racing that Leiter had warned him he would see on the first afternoon of the meeting. But it was a beautiful day, and Bond enjoyed absorbing the Saratoga idiom, the mixture of Brooklyn and Kentucky in the milling crowds, the elegance of the owners and their friends in the tree-shaded paddock, the efficient mechanics of the Pari Mutuel, and the big board with its flashing lights recording the odds and the money invested, the trouble-free starts through the tractor-drawn starting gate, the toy lake with its six swans and the anchored canoe, and everywhere that extra exotic touch of the Negroes, who, except as jockeys, are so much a part of American racing. The organization looked better than in England. There seemed less chance of crookedness, where so much crookedness had been insured against. But back of it all, Bond knew that the illegal wire services were relaying the results of each race throughout the states, cutting the tote odds to a maximum of 28-4, 20s for a win, 8s for first or second, and 4s for a place, and that millions of dollars every year were going straight into the pockets of gangsters to whom racing was just another source of revenue, like prostitution or drugs. Bond tried out the system made famous by Chicago O'Brien. He backed every firm favorite for a place, or to show, as his first ticket hatch told him to call it, and he had somehow made $15 and some cents by the end of the eighth race and the day's meeting. He walked home with the crowds, had a shower and some sleep, and then found his way to a restaurant near the sales ring and spent an hour drinking the drink that Leiter had told him was fashionable in racing circles, bourbon and branch water. Bond guessed that, in fact, the water was from the tap behind the bar, but Leiter had said that real bourbon drinkers insist on having their whiskey in the traditional style, with water from high up in the branch of the local river where it will be purest. The barman didn't seem surprised when he asked for it, and Bond was amused at the conceit. Then he ate an adequate steak, and after a final bourbon, walked over to the sales ring, which Leiter had fixed as a rendezvous. It was a white-painted wooden enclosure, roofed but without walls, in which tiered benches descended to a circle of mock greensward enclosed with silver-painted ropes in front of the auctioneer's platform. As each horse was led in under the glare of the neon lighting, the auctioneer, the redoubtable Swinebroad from Tennessee, would give the history of the horse and start the bidding at what he thought a likely figure, and run it up through the hundreds in a kind of rhythmic chant, catching, with the help of two dinner-jacketed men in the aisles, every nod or raised pencil among the tiers of smartly dressed owners and agents. Bond sat down behind a scrawny woman in evening dress and mink, whose wrists clanked and glittered with jewelry every time she bid. Beside her sat a bored man in a white dinner jacket and a dark red evening tie, who might have been her husband or her trainer. A nervous bay came chassying into the ring with the number 201 pasted carelessly on his rump. The harsh chant began. Ambit 6,000, now 7,000, will you? Ambit 7,000, and 3, and 4, and 5, only 7.5 for this good-looking colt by Tehran. 8,000, thank you, sir, and 9, will you do it? 8,500, ambit, will you give me 9? 8,500, will you give me 9? 6 and 7, and who'll bid the big figure? A pause, a bang of the hammer, a look of sincere reproach towards the ringside seats where the big money sat. Folks, this 2-year-old's too cheap. I'm selling more winning colt for this amount of money than I've sold all summer long. Now, 8,700, who'll give me 9? Where's 9? 9, 9. The mummified hand in the rings and bracelets took the golden bamboo pencil out of the bag and scribbled a calculation on the program, which Bond could see said 34th Annual Saratoga Yearling Sales, number 201, a bay colt. Then the leaden eyes of the woman looked across the silver ropes into the electric eyes of the horse, and she raised the gold pencil. And 9,000 is bid. 9. Will you give me 10? Will you do it? Any increase on 9,000? Do I hear 9-1, 9-1, 9-1? A pause and a last questing look round the crammed white seats, and then a bang of the hammer. Sold for $9,000. Thank you, ma'am. And the heads turned round and craned, and the woman looked bored and said something to the man beside her, who shrugged his shoulders.
and 201, a bay colt, was led from the ring, and 202 came sidling in to stand for a moment, trembling with the shock of the lights and the wall of unknown faces and the fog of strange smells. And there was a movement in the row of seats behind Bond, and Leiter's face came forward alongside his, and Leiter's mouth said into his ear, "It's done. It's cost $3,000, but he'll play the double cross. Foul riding in the last furlong, just as he's due to make his winning sprint. Oh, boy. See you in the morning." And the whisper ended, and Bond didn't look round, but went on watching the sails for a while, and then slowly walked home under the elms, feeling sorry for a jockey called Tingling Bell, who was playing such a desperately dangerous game, and for a big chestnut called Shy Smile, who was now not only a ringer, but was going to be ridden foul into the bargain.
Chapter 12. The Perpetuities. Bond sat high up in the grandstand and through hired glasses watched Shy Smile's owner eating soft-shell crabs. The gangster was sitting in the restaurant enclosure four rows below Bond. Opposite him sat Rosie Budd forking down frankfurters and sauerkraut and drinking beer out of a stein. Although most of the other luncheon tables were occupied, there were two waiters hovering round this one, and the maitre d'hôtel made frequent visits to see that all was going well. Pizarro looked like a gangster in a horror comic. He had a round, bladder-like head, in the middle of which the features were crowded together, two pinpoint eyes, two black nostrils, a pursed, wet, pink mouth above the hint of a chin, and a fat body in a brown suit and a white shirt with a long, pointed collar and a figured chocolate bow tie. He paid no attention to the preparations of the first race, but concentrated on his food, occasionally glancing across at his companion's plate as if he might reach across and fork something off it for himself. Rosie Budd was broad and hard-looking, with a square, immobile poker player's face in which pale eyes were buried deep under thin, fair eyebrows. He was wearing a striped seersucker suit and a dark blue tie. He ate slowly and rarely looked up from his plate. When he had finished, he picked up a race program and studied it, turning over the pages carefully. Without looking up, he gave a curt shake of the head when the maitre d'hôtel offered him the menu. Pizarro picked his teeth until a mound of ice cream arrived, and then he bent his head again and started spooning the ice cream rapidly up into his small mouth. Through his glasses, Bond examined the two men and wondered about them. What did these people amount to? Bond remembered cold, dedicated, chess-playing Russians, brilliant, neurotic Germans, silent, deadly, anonymous men from Central Europe, the people in his own service, the double firsts, the gay soldiers of fortune, the men who counted life well lost for 1,000 a year. Compared with such men, Bond decided, these people were just teenage pillow fantasies. The results went up for the third race, and now there was only half an hour to go before the perpetuities. Bond put down his glasses and picked up his program, waiting for the big board on the other side of the track to start flickering as the money went on the tote and the odds began to move. He took a final look at the details. Second day, August 4, said the program. The perpetuities stakes, $25,000 added, 52nd running, for three-year-olds, by subscription of $50 each to accompany the nomination, starters to pay $250 additional, with the $25,000 added, of which $5,000 to second, $2,500 to third, and $1,250 to fourth, a trophy to be presented to the owner of the winner, 1 mile and a quarter, and then the list of 12 horses with owners, trainers, and jockeys, and the morning line forecast of the odds. The joint favourites, number 1, Mr. C.V. Whitney's Come Again, and number 3, Mr. William Woodward's Pray Action, were both forecast at 6-4 on. Mr. P. Pizarro's Shy Smile, trainer R. Budd, jockey T. Bell, was forecast at 15-1, the bottom horse in the betting. His number was 10. Bond turned his glasses on the restaurant enclosure. The two men had gone. Bond's eyes followed on across the track to where the lights were flashing on the big board. The favourite was now number 3 at 2-1 on. Come Again had gone out to evens. Shy Smile was quoted at 20-1, but he went down to 18s as Bond watched the board. Another quarter of an hour to go. Bond sat back and lit a cigarette, going over again in his mind what Leiter had told him, wondering if it was going to work. Leiter had tracked the jockey down to his rooming house and had flashed his private detective's license at him. And then he had quite calmly blackmailed him into throwing the race. If Shy Smile won, Leiter would go to the stewards, expose the ringer, and Tingling Bell would never ride again. But there was one chance for the jockey to save himself. If he took it, Leiter promised to say nothing about the ringer. Shy Smile must win the race, but be disqualified. This could be achieved if, in the final sprint, the jockey interfered with the running of the horse closest to him, so that it could be shown that he had prevented this other horse from being the winner. Then there would be an objection, which had to be upheld. It would be easy for Bell, at the last corner before the run-in, to do this in such a way that he could argue to his employers that it had just been a bit of over-keen riding, that another horse had crowded him over to the left, that his horse had stumbled. There was no conceivable reason why he should not wish to win. Bizarro had promised him an extra $1,000 if he did, and it was just one of those strokes of bad luck that happen in racing. And Leiter would now give Tingling $1,000, and there would be another $2,000 for him if he did what he was told. And Bell had bought it, without any hesitation. And he had asked for the $2,000 to be passed to him after the day's racing in the Acme Mud and Sulphur Baths, where he went every evening to take a mud bath to keep his weight down. 6 o'clock. And Leiter had promised that this would be done. And Bond now had the $2,000 in his pocket, and he had reluctantly agreed to help Leiter out by going to the Acme Baths to make the payoff if Shy Smile failed to win the race. Would it work? Bond picked up his glasses and swept them round the course. He noted the four thick posts at the quarter miles that held the automatic cameras that recorded the whole race and whose film was available to the stewards within minutes of each finish. It was this last one, near the winning post, whose eye would see and record all that happened at the final bend. Bond felt a tingle of excitement. 5 minutes to go, and the starting gate was being pulled into position 100 yards up to his left. Once round the course, plus an extra furlong, and the winning post was just below him. He put his glasses on the big board. No change in the favourites or in Shy Smile's price. And now here came the horses, cantering easily down to the start. First came number one, Come Again, the second favourite, a big black horse carrying the light blue and brown colours of the Whitney stable. And there was a cheer for the favourite, Pray Action, a fast-looking grey, carrying the woodward white and red spots of the famous Bel Air stud. And at the tail of the field, there was the big chestnut with a blaze face and four white stockings, and the pale-faced jockey wearing a jacket of lavender silk with a big black diamond on chest and back. The horse moved so well that Bond glanced across at the board and was not surprised to see his price come quickly back to 17s, then 16s. Bond went on watching the board. In a minute the big money would go on, all except the remains of Bond's $1,000, which would stay in his pocket, and the price would come down with a run. The loudspeaker was announcing the race. Away to the left, the horses were being marshalled behind the starting gate. Bing, 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 the lights opposite, number 10 on the board, started to wink and flash. 15, 14, 12, 11, and finally 9-1. Then the lights stopped talking, and the tote was closed. And how many more thousands had gone away by Western Union to harmless telegraphic addresses in Detroit, Chicago, New York, Miami, San Francisco, and a dozen more off-the-course books throughout the states? A handbell clanged sharply. There was an electric smell in the air, and a muting of the noise of the crowds. Then down thundered the ragged charging line towards the grandstand, and passed and away in a scud of hooves and flying earth and tan bark. There was a glimpse of sharp, pale faces half hidden by goggles, a stream of pounding shoulders and hindquarters, a flash of wild white eyes, and a confusion of numbers, amongst which Bond caught only the vital number 10, well to the fore and close into the rails. And then the dust was settling, and the brown-black mass was at the first corner, and slowly streaming round the bottom straight, and Bond felt the glasses slip and the sweat round his eyes. Number 5, a black outsider, was leading by a length.
was this some unknown horse that was going to steal the show? But then there was number one, level with them, and then number three, and number ten, half a length behind the leaders. Just these four out in front, and the rest bunched three lengths away. Round the corner, and now number one was in the lead, the Whitney Black, and number ten was fourth. Down the long straight opposite, and number three was moving up, with Tingling Bell on the chestnut at his heels. They both passed number five, and were well up with number one, who was still leading by half a length. And then the first top bend, and the top straight, and number three was leading, with Shy Smile second, and number one a length behind. And Shy Smile was coming up level with the leader. He was level, and they were coming into the final corner. Bond held his breath. Now, now! He could almost hear the whir of the concealed camera and the big white post. Number ten was ahead, right on the bend, but number three was inside on the rails, and the crowd was howling for the favourite. Now Bell was inching towards the grey, his head well down on his horse's neck on the outside, so that he could pretend that he couldn't see the grey horse on the rails. Inch by inch, the horses drew closer, and suddenly Shy Smile's head hit number three's head. Then his quarters were in front, and yes, Prey Action's boy suddenly stood right up in his stirrups, forced to take up by the foul, and at once Shy Smile was a length ahead. There was an angry roar from the crowd. Bond lowered his glasses and sat back and watched as the foam-flecked chestnut thundered past the post below him, with Prey Action five lengths behind and Come Again just failing to beat him into second place. Not bad, thought Bond, as the crowd howled around him. Not bad at all. And how brilliantly the jockey had done it. His head so well down that even Pizarro would have to admit Bell couldn't see the other horse. The natural curve in for the final straight, the head still well down as he passed the post, and the whip flailing for the last few lengths, as if Tingling still thought himself only half a length ahead of number three. Bond watched for the results to be posted. There was a chorus of whistles and catcalls. Number ten, Shy Smile, five lengths. Number three, Prey Action, half a length. Number one, Come Again, three lengths. Number seven, Pirandello, three lengths. And the horses came cantering back for the weighing in, and the crowd yelled for blood as Tingling Bell, grinning all over his face, threw his whip to the valet and slipped off the sweating chestnut and carried his saddle to the scales. And then there was a great burst of cheering. Opposite the name of Shy Smile, the word Objection, white on black, had been slipped in, and the loudspeaker was saying, "Attention, please. In this race there has been an objection lodged by Jockey T. Lucky and number three, Prey Action, against the riding of Jockey T. Bell and number ten, Shy Smile. Do not destroy your tickets. I repeat, do not destroy your tickets." Bond took out his handkerchief and wiped his hands. He could imagine the scene in the projection room behind the judge's box. Now they would be examining the film. Bell would be standing there, looking hurt, and beside him number three's jockey, looking still more hurt. Would the owners be there? Would the sweat be running down Pizarro's fat jowls into his collar? Would some of the other owners be there, pale and angry? And then came the loudspeaker again, and the voice saying, "Attention, please. In this race, number 10, Shy Smile, has been disqualified, and number 3, Prey Action, has been declared the winner. The result is now official." Amidst the thunder of the crowd, Bond got stiffly up from his seat and walked in the direction of the bar. And now for the payoff. Perhaps a bourbon and branch water would give him some ideas about getting the money to Tingling Bell. He was uneasy about it. And yet the Acme Bath sounded an easy enough place. Nobody knew him in Saratoga. But after that, he would have to stop working for Pinkerton's, call up Shady Tree and complain about not getting his 5,000, worry him about his own payoff. It had been fun helping Lighter push these people around. Next would come Bond's turn. He pushed his way into the crowded bar. End of side 6.